And to see that God, in the mouth of Isaiah, would put a piece in, and in the mouth of Jeremiah would fit the other piece, and they would perfectly fit, and in the mouth of Ezekiel would fit another piece, and that all three fit perfectly. And the whole book of God could only be woven by a master. I learned recently something that I think has an analogy. I believe any area of truth you can teach from it. Some of you that know about Persian rugs and know the Kurban Persian rugs, and there are others of the same period that were outlawed in Iran, know how they were made, which is why they're so expensive and why they are so prized. Palace rugs. Children made them. Terrible thing. Should have been outlawed. But those best Persian rugs are made by tying hundreds and hundreds of little knots behind the rugs. Children's hands are the only ones small enough to do it. So, a very expensive Persian rug, no doubt, made 75, 80 years ago, occupied 6, 7, or 8 kids, 6, 7, or 8 years, with tiny hands tying the knots. Two masters bossed them. One who bossed the work. Another who sang. And by analogy, though much more complicated, as a square dance caller tells the dancer which move to make, the singer, by his singing, controlled the weaving of the colors. So the master singer, if he sang right, different hands tying, the colors would come out right. The reason it was outlawed, that intensive work day after day by those developing children with their tiny hands, they'd go blind. Just, you know, every attention, hour after hour, on the sound of the singing guide as they tied the knots and put the fabric together. And it was outlawed, should have been. And it's probably one of the worst abuses of child labor known. But that's what makes Persian rugs so irreplaceable and priceless. They can never be done again. Well, by analogy, that's the way, and he wasn't dealing with kids, and he was a good master, and his rewards were eternal. So that's the way God wrote his book. If you could have the prophetic hands tying it, so to speak, you can look at a Persian rug and see the pattern, though many hands put it together. You look at God's book and see it as a whole. You know there's a master singing the song that guides it somewhere. I have that faith in God's book. As I've come to see in the skeletal structures of the pyramid that no man could have built it, and as I've come to see that God coordinated it as a testimonial, I've approached it in my studies the way I approach God's book, refusing to be bent out of shape by somebody who wants to make a pet theory work. Rather, let it speak for itself. And as you look at the full spectrum of those that were just beginning, you realize it's only in recent years that people were able to get into that pyramid, historically speaking, and see the pattern and measure it. They made errors en route. In their over-eagerness, pyramidologists were like prophecy teachers who too often put on white robes with a false date and got ready for the Lord to come. Now, I'm going to tell you at the outset. This guy is one of the best scholars that I've ever read. Adam Rutherford. He wrote this in 1972. The first book was printed in 57, the second in 62, the third in 66, the fourth in 72, the fifth was in preparation and never finished. Maybe this will tell you why. Bless his heart, he got carried away. You sure you're ready for this? I like to read things like a woman sometimes, from back. I went to the end of the book. I checked him out at the end. You ready for this? And you'll understand why I can't just put a book in your hand and say, this is it. There isn't any. The day in which we now live is known but two names in the Bible. The day of His preparation, Nahum 2, verses 3 to 4, and the time of the end, Daniel 12, 4. The initial period of which is defined the Great Pyramid's chronograph as A.D. 1440 to 1521. The time of the end, in its more specific application, refers to the era from the end of the domination of the papacy in A.D. 1798, when Napoleon captured the Pope, to the end of the present world order, due in blank. He said when? I'm going to tell you. I'm not going to dangle you. Its duration is precisely half a prophetic time. Half of 360 years, which is 180 years. The beginning of the time of the end is defined prophetically by the termination of the three and a half times of 1260 years of Daniel's prophecy, chapter 7, 25, and 12, 7, in 1798. Whilst the end of the time of the end, the beginning of the time of the end is 1798. The end of the time of the end coincides with the destruction of the old order in blank, prophetically defined with the termination of 2300 days, Daniel 8:14, and of the Jubilee cycles, as well as being the final terminal of the 1335 days of Daniel 12:12, as elucidated in detail in another one of his books. The day of His preparation for the new world order, the kingdom of God, and the time of the end of the old world order are synchronous or synonymous or synchronized, and the respective processes culminate together in blank, which is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the controversy of Zion. This means to say that the end of this world order comes precisely four times or 1440 years after the beginning of Daniel's three and a half times in A.D. 538. A pattern of prophetic times apparently runs through the divine plan of the ages, for from the birth of Christ to the inauguration of the millennium in blank is exactly five and a half times or blank years. I'll read it slow. The beginning of the time of the end is defined prophetically with a termination three and a half times 1260 years of Daniel's prophecy in 1798. Whilst the end of the time of the end and the destruction of the old order, the time of the end of the old world order, the inauguration of the millennium, is exactly 1979. I wouldn't finish my fifth book either if 79 came and went and I was wrong. Now, without putting this dear man down, who has made one of the greatest contributions to scholarship ever made on the subject, he did the same thing David Davidson did. David Davidson picked 1936, and the Davidson clubs waited for the world to end in 1936. And he fell into disrepute. Then along comes Adam Rutherford, the greatest scholarship ever. But he decided that the inch to a month people were heretical. And he tears them apart. I'll read where he tears them apart. Then he turns right around and picks a date, 1979, and makes a failing prophet of himself in his eagerness. And this is what has turned people off on the study of the pyramid, because some of the best ones get overeager. Part of Rutherford's theory stands and falls. You can read four volumes, and the nexus of his whole argument is, as he abandons the inch to a month, there can be no time chronography on granite. It must be on limestone. because his inch to a year without a change ends up in 1979 when the limestone in the passage to the king's chamber turns to red granite. So he therefore decides there can be no calendar on granite because he wants the world to end in 1979. Because he made his choice. Now, to the people that say, well, then it ain't worth the effort if they can be that wrong, I'm going to say, did you quit studying the Bible because people have done the same thing with the Bible? Let me tell you, just about every one of the Old Testament scholars that preserve the books that make up our Old Testament that Jesus quoted and gave sanction to were equally wrong in their understandings of the first coming of Christ. But we don't throw the Old Testament out. We search the Scripture to get its meaning. Now, I try to tell some of you overeager ones that want to run off, I have to walk a tightrope. I know why the Catholics put an index. There is a legitimacy in trying to keep some people from reading things they aren't ready for. And the legitimacy is Jesus cloaked certain truths in parables, literally hid the truth in a parable because they weren't ready for it yet. That's the legitimate reason for a church saying you need to study certain things in sequence. That's the legitimacy for prerequisites in curricular arrangements in college. You study one thing before you study another thing, and you can't short-circuit it. You can speed it up, but you got to go through the sequence. The evil of an index is when men who want to perpetuate error, when they know the truth but are afraid somebody else will find out about it, they try to keep you from confronting the truth. In between is the proper attitude. No, I will tell you what to read. I'm not trying to keep you from reading anything, but I'm telling you, the service I'm trying to provide on the air is to steer you until you can form your own conclusions and let the truth speak for itself. And when somebody like Rutherford kicks everybody out because they disagree with him, go to the last page and see how wrong he was on 1979 and distinguish between the man's opinion and the facts that he offers. And with that, I'm going to show you the history, and maybe you can start sorting out the pyramid. You say, well, Scott, are you going to give us a date? No. I've preached and told you 100 times. I cannot tell you when the Lord's going to come. I can tell you when he won't come. The rapture will not take place, and I'm willing to bet, will not take place during these reigns. The Lord will not come and take his church home this February or this March or this April or this May. He won't even do it in June. The Lord will come on time and take his church home on the same day in God's calendar that he came the first time. He was born on the Feast of the Trumpets. He said, how can you be so sure? Because nobody can ever prove me wrong. Nobody. Nobody. Until somebody figures out a scientific way to bring out of the rocks of Palestine and the petrified woods therein the sound that may be stored therein. Nobody can ever perfect a calendar to the day. But the Bible indicates that God's feast days were prophetic. And Jesus was born on the Feast of the Trumpets, crucified on the Passover, buried at the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, rose on the day of the first fruits. The Spirit came on the day of Pentecost. It had to come exactly that day. It could not fall one day sooner or one day later. And he will come a second time to take his church home when the Feast of the Trumpets blows. Therefore, if it's not somewhere close to that day, in January, February, and March, are not even close. The Lord will not come in March. Oh, no, the Lord will not come in March. Well, is he going to come on the Feast of the Trumpets in the fall of 1983? Maybe, but not necessarily. Well, what if he doesn't? and he won't come until the same time, 1984. If you're one of those skin of the teeth people, just live like hell between Septembers. The risk you take is the Holy Spirit may be so sick of you, he won't even make you want to return to him when the next September rolls around. You don't play fast and loose with him. But no, the Lord will not come tonight to take his church home. I knew old Scott was going to go off the deep end. I knew it would happen. You want to make a bet? I will. I would like to have 4 million people bet me a dollar that he will come between now and next September. I feel with some people, like the old cowboy did that got berated because when he was in the church, everybody, this is my dad's story. This is the fifth time I've told it since I've been here. I keep book. He was in a country church, and the preacher said, everybody wants to go to heaven, stand on your feet. Everybody stood with the old cowboy. When they sat down, then the preacher, he had a sinner to berate, which was why he preached. And he took off on the cowboy for not wanting to go to heaven. The cowboy just got up and drew a six-shooter and just sort of turned around and said, everybody wants to go to heaven, stand on your feet. And nobody got up. Nobody. Now, I'm willing to put myself on the line. I will bet you that the rapture of the church will not take place after New Year's Day or any time between New Year's Day and midsummer. I'll bet you. Now, if the Lord comes between now and September, I lose. You can't lose your bet. You go up. If he doesn't come, I will give you a... I'm going to let it be 120. I'm 53. 47. 67. I will make the bet last for 66 years. I want to be paid in the 66th year. The Lord will not come except on the Feast of the Trumpets to take his church up. Because if he does, his prophetic pattern is broken. I'm furthermore going to say that anybody that tries to say differently is messing around with God's types just as much as Moses when he hit the rock a second time. We're going to have fun tonight. I will not say when he's going to come. You say, well, haven't you indicated that a lot of the indices of the time of God working certain things out just about run, will run, into the next decade? Yeah, I have. I'm saying that God's just about used up all the signposts. And Jesus said, you can read the weather. You can't read the sign of my coming. Pay attention. Certain things will happen, but the time is not yet. Then another thing will happen, but the time is not yet. And you can know when it's even at the door. I've already preached on what's at the door. It's not what some people think it is. But I will tell you this. Signs must be completed before the end comes, whenever that is. In between here and the end, there's a catching away of the church. It will be on some Feast of the Trumpets. And all of man's errors in all calendars will be corrected. And when we get in heaven, we'll sit around and say, you know, here's a Jewish calendar that I never could really understand down on earth, but I got the Lord, he's a Jew, he can help me. And this Gregorian calendar, and this Chinese calendar, and this astrological chart, I'm going to work it out now. I'm going to spend the first 1,000 years getting all these dates figured out until God can say to me, I told you so, with precision. but it'll be a feast of the trumpets. Now, the pyramid, likewise, doesn't tell you, doesn't tie God's hands in regard to final events. It sharpens the focus as you get there. It pinpoints certain key dates, and you can locate them. The mistake of pyramidologists has been the same as the mistake of Bible prophecy teachers in trying to do too much and box God in. They have literally damaged all that God has done to their shame. Now, let's do it differently. Now, can I read you some history? The view that the Great Pyramid was something more than merely a tomb has been held. What I'm going to do now for two nights is take you through the whole history of every major voice that has looked at the pyramid, what contribution they made, and where their errors may have laid, until you then can survey all the literature, and with me we'll finally find a book that has the fewest number of errors and the most amount of truth, or we'll write one. Is that all right? I'm getting hot in the process. Turn the cooler on. You see, when we're in the King's House One on Sunday, I take a vote. Who's hot, who's cold, who's just right, and the just writers get it. And Sammy, he stays in the heat. Here, we take a vote. Gene, when he's too hot, we turn the cooler down. When Gene's too cold, we turn the cooler off. The only vote we take in King's House Two is my vote. And I'm too hot. Which is why a lot of people are glad we've moved over to King's House One. Now I'm going to give you all this history. The view that the Great Pyramid was something more than merely a tomb has been held by various people for several centuries. But the real purpose of this pyramid, more than saying it wasn't a tomb, was not discovered until the latter part of the 19th century. In the Middle Ages, star worshippers held meetings in the Great Pyramid. As far back as AD 66, Kircher expressed the view that it might have secret mystic significance. 1693, astronomical purposes begin to be recognized. I'm skipping. 1714, sundial markings and the exact time of the solstices were recognized. Partly based upon the old idea that the form of the pyramid represented the diverging rays of the sun upon the earth, several writers during the latter part of the 18th century and the early part of the 19th century maintained the base measurements of the Great Pyramid were intended to represent the number of days in a year. Then, sir, and write these names down because they'll be quoted everywhere. Then, Sir Gardner Wilkinson, I want you to notice how many of them were British and Scotch. Wherever you turn, you keep coming across this thread. Those British, those Scotch, those Irish are still God's instrument to reveal God's revelation. Sir Gardner Wilkinson in the 1840s was the first eminent Egyptologist to throw doubt upon the tomb theory, so far as the Great Pyramid is concerned. In 1853, at the request of the French astronomer and physicist, Jean-Baptiste Biot, another distinguished Egyptologist, Auguste Ferdinand Mariette took observations of the vernal equinox of that year and found that the Great Pyramid did indeed function as a huge sundial marking the equinoxes annually, whether this was intentional or not. Then the year 1859 witnessed the publication of the first book to announce that the Great Pyramid was built under divine inspiration. Didn't say much about the inside, but in September of that year, John Taylor of London, write his name down, 1859, significant date. We noticed these dates when we looked at archaeology in other areas. 1859, John Taylor of London published his work, The Great Pyramid. Why was it built and who built it? For many years, he lived at 30 Gower Street, close to the British Museum with its colossal library, in which he spent much time doing research. It was after many years of study that John Taylor published his book on the Great Pyramid. Now, some of you think, boy, I'm so old. Why didn't I find this out sooner? John Taylor published his book at the advanced age of 78 and lived 5 years more to expand his authority on it. Died in 1864 at his last residence, Kensington, in the western part of London. So AD 1859 goes down in history as the date of the birth of modern pyramidology that credits to God the building of this pyramid. He did it for reasons I'll tell you next hour.